today on Against the Grain. They said, the bosses have two parties. We need one of our own. In 1996, representatives and activists from hundreds of local and international unions came together to launch a workers' party, long missing in U.S. politics. Labor Party participant and economist Howard Botwinick discusses the organization's challenges and enduring promise, and the lessons from its rise and fall, including how the failure to build a left-wing politics rooted in the working class created a vacuum that was ultimately filled by the right. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Most advanced industrial countries have a labor party, with the glaring exception of the United States. In the mid-1990s, in the face of the Democratic Party's right-wing turn under Bill Clinton, workers and unions joined together to launch an American Labor Party. Left academic and former machinist Howard Botwinick was one of many involved in bringing the Labor Party to life. He was one of the primary authors of its program for economic justice and served for 2 years as the vice chair of the New York Labor Party. He joins me today. Howard, what was the genesis of the Labor Party? Why was it seen as necessary?
Well, if we go back to the 1990s, there were a number of things that were coming together that made the Labor Party something to seriously consider. First of all, in the early 90s, you had the betrayal of the Democratic Party through Bill Clinton in terms of the passage of NAFTA and his Welfare Reform Act, if you remember, to end welfare as we know it, was a devastating blow to labor. People who understood, I mean, the mainstream economists all supported it, but people who understood labor issues knew that that NAFTA agreement, the free trade agreement, was going to be devastating for working people in the United States, who would be directly put into competition with low-wage labor all over the world. And so when Clinton fought and pushed through what was Herbert Walker Bush's NAFTA program, he couldn't get it through, but Clinton pushed it through. That was like the last straw in terms of the Democratic Party. People were really furious about that and the welfare reform. The other thing that was going on that people forget is that wages, income equality was exploding since the early 70s. And so we forget this because there's so much talk about other issues besides just class inequality. Other than Bernie, not many people have been talking about this. And between 1979 and 2007, the bottom 60% of families in the United States experienced either very slow growth or stagnating real income despite working 15 weeks of work more per family. So people were working more, adding more members of the family, and yet they were stagnating in terms of their income levels. So things were very different. And up until the 70s, things were growing. For every decile in the population, people were improving between 1945 and 1970. That was a time where all across the board you had a lot of growth, but that stopped and things, inequality started exploding, wages started stagnating, and people were very unhappy about what was happening. So there was all of those issues. And to give one more sense of that, how bad the bottom had fallen out. In 1973, a high school male who just entered the workforce would have been earning about $16 an hour. That's in 2011 dollars. By the time we got to 2011, that $16 an hour wage went down to $11. So we're talking about a massive decline. Women also declined, but not as fast. And so ironically, the gap between high school and men and women closed, but mainly because the men fell much faster than the women. So, and the, of course, the high school college premium also was exploding at this time and continued to go up. In 1979, the college premium was 30%. By the time we get to 2024, it's 58%. If you went to college, on average, you were going to earn 58% more than someone who just went to high school. So this explosion of inequality was part of the background. And of course, if it sounds familiar, we know that inequality has continued to this day. The other thing that was important for the timing of the Labor Party was that the labor movement was showing some promising things that were happening. There was the election of a new president of the AFL-CIO in the 90s, and his name was John Sweeney from the SEIU, the Service Employees Union, and he was promising and was elected on a campaign to put enormous amount of resources into new organizing, that we were going to finally grow the labor movement, and it was exciting. It seemed like things were going to change. So you put the inequality explosion, you put the betrayal of the Democratic Party, and then exciting new things that seemed to be happening in the labor movement. It seemed like the time to begin to talk about that. And Tony Mazzocchi, who was the head of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, who was very instrumental in developing the whole idea around the Labor Party, he began with OCAW members to start sending out questionnaires to local unions about how they felt about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Did those parties represent working people? Did they have any faith in those parties to solve the problems that working people were facing? And 65% said no. They had no faith in either the Democratic or the Republican Party. And so the Labor Party advocates' slogan became, "The bosses have two parties, we should have at least one." And so that sort of kicked off this campaign that went on for over 3 years, until 1996, when we had our convention in Cleveland.
The United States is pretty notable in not having a labor party, you know, in comparison to other economically advanced industrial countries. The U.S. really stands out in that a labor party has not been part of our history, even though in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was, you know, enormous class struggle and upheaval in this country. How did those of you who were involved in forming the Labor Party think about that history and why a Labor Party in the 90s would have been able to sort of break the mold?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, that's a tough question that we're all still scratching our head about, how it was that we had this negative kind of American exceptionalism in terms of labor history. As you said, one of the most militant histories of class struggle in the United States, coupled with the lack of a labor party. But we have always, those of us in the Labor Party, felt that this was one of the main reasons why we had not won, the working people in America had not won so many of the gains that the European working class had won. No national health care, parental leaves, sick leave, vacation leave, all of those things were atrocious in the United States compared to what working people had gained in Europe through social democratic parties or labor parties, or at least a party that at least pretended, or in many cases did, speak for the interests of working people that were in fact acknowledged to be different from the interests of capitalists or corporations. In this country, you barely heard anyone dare to say that kind of thing, that corporate interests and the interests of working people were opposed to each other. That was blasphemy because of the absence of a left since the McCarthy period, really. I mean, I and many of us consider that a watershed moment when we lost that connection between the left and the labor movement. And it was not an accident. It was a very clear, determined effort by those who rule this country to get rid of the left and the labor movement and tame it, so to speak, so that capital could get on with its agenda after World War II.
And how did that shape the landscape of labor? We're heading into another period of, you know, repression of dissent and the left. How did McCarthyism create a long shadow for decades that affected how unions operated?
Well, you know, first we have to understand that among the progressive unions that were organizing in the 1930s, the left played a very important role. The CIO unions in auto and steel, rubber tire, electrical equipment, people on the left were intimately involved in all of those struggles. And many went into the plants. It wasn't just intellectuals on the outside, but people were involved from the ground floor to build those unions. And so it wasn't a tangential relationship. It was a fundamental relationship during the 1930s. And the best unions that we've seen in many cases came out of that time. They were great on racial oppression and other issues. They were much more democratic. They were understood that in order to beat capital, you had to build a fighting force. You had to often go out on strike. Otherwise, you would not be able to win those kinds of gains. So that relationship with the left was very important. And the McCarthy period just severed that. You know, thousands of people were run out of the unions. And opportunist elements in the labor movement used the McCarthy period to push their much more conservative agenda. And many good CIO unions became defunct or were raided by other unions. The United Electrical Workers and the Longshoremen Workers Union and a few others were some of the only unions that kind of made it through that terrible time. And so it was, and it was also during a period of growth, you know, coming after World War II, the economy was strong in the United States. And so you could make some accommodations for at least the organized portion of the labor movement to allow wages to go up slowly with productivity without threatening capital. Profitability was high, and as long as only a certain amount of unions were there in a certain percentage, let's say 25 to 35% of the labor force was organized, capital could absorb that. And so there was this, what we call capital labor accords. People forget that the foundation of it was the destruction of the left and the destruction of those militant progressive unions. But so that was the sort of labor peace, if you will, that excluded a large portion of the working class from unions. It allowed also capital. This is a very unique situation in the United States where, because it's such a vast country, it allowed capital to have an area within its own borders where they could get cheaper labor, significantly cheaper labor, disregard environmental regulations and a whole host of other things by just moving south. That was, you know, no other country had that kind of situation as far as I know. And so all of that was happening when, so even the good unions in the North, in steel and auto, when it became time for capital to build new plants, which are very costly, they didn't build them up north for the most part. The majority of those new plants were built below the Mason-Dixon line. And so that destruction of the left in the labor movement was a very, very important watershed. That led to a lot of the weakness in the labor movement, and then also in terms of our ability to win gains for working people as a whole. in terms of national health care. As Bernie constantly reminds us, we're the only advanced industrialized nation that doesn't consider health care a right, a human right, and we don't have some kind of a national health care program. A big part of the reason for that is that we lost our vibrant labor movement, and we did not have a political party that proudly, unequivocally spoke for working people. And that became more and more clear, as I said, once we got into the 90s. It even started with Jimmy Carter, who refused to push through a very weak labor law reform bill in the late 70s that would have just put some teeth in the National Labor Relations Act. But they couldn't even get that through, and that was with Democrats in leadership in all in the both houses, and in of course with the presidency. So that was a good sign of how things had changed and labor had become weak economically and politically.
Economist Howard Botwinick is my guest. He was one of the primary authors of the draft program of the Labor Party's program of economic justice. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about the formation of the Labor Party in the mid-1990s, an episode that many people do not know about labor and left history in the U.S., and the lessons for today of that experience. So, Howard, you were talking about the conditions in the 1990s that led people within unions to recognize that they needed an alternative to the Democratic Party. And you mentioned earlier Tony Mazzocchi, who was one of the leaders of this Labor Party project. And I wonder if you could tell us who he was, what kind of world did he come out of, and what role did he play in shaping the Labor Party?
That's a topic in and of itself. And in fact, I would refer your listeners to a book by Les Leopold about on Tony Mazzocchi and his life. I think the subtitle is The Man Who Loved Labor and Hated Work, which was a great way to describe Tony. But Tony was a guy who grew up, he was influenced by a lot of those early struggles in the 40s and 50s. I think he knew quite a few people on the left as he was growing up and in his family and elsewhere. He became active in the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union very early on and got involved in union work on the ground floor. Tony was an amazing guy in so many ways. He never went to college, but boy, he was well-read. When we were doing Labor Party work, Adolf Reed and I, who were involved intimately in this developing of the program for economic and social justice, Tony would get off the plane to meet us, and he'd always have two or three books under his arm and say, did you look at this? Did you read this? This is terrific. And what did you think of this? I don't know if I want to spend my time reading this. I mean, it was amazing. He was more well-read than a lot of academics that I've known. And so he was an autodidact, if you will, self-taught intellectual. And he was an incredible leader. He was considered the father of the health and safety movement. He spearheaded the fight to get the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act and many of the other issues around health and safety. He was a very creative guy. He was the guy who really was the founder of the idea of the just transition movement, that if we want to really deal seriously with the environment, we have to have a way to join with the labor movement to make sure that working people are made whole when they lose their jobs, if they lose their jobs because of some environmental issue, that they will be retrained and they will be taken care of and set up well, and in contract language you say made whole. This was a very important piece, and he was very intimately connected with environmentalists. So he was not your typical trade unionist in a lot of ways. And he understood the importance of a labor party. He understood And he would talk about this a lot in the early days, trying to get enthusiasm around. He would talk about how unions are great, but they're sectoral interests. You know, the oil, chemical, atomic workers there, they have a particular industry, the steel workers another. And many times those interests are not the same, or they're isolated from each other. And who's going to take care of the unemployed? And who's going to fight for health care reform for working people across the country? You need a labor party. You need a political party to pull working people from all of the different sectors and all of the different issues together to form a more cohesive force. And that we've never had that in this country. And as I said before, that's one of the things that was missing that Europeans have had coming out of World War II, which we did not have. And it's one of the reasons they had so many more gains in terms of the vibrant public sector and so many other issues. So Tony was just one of those guys that really understood those issues, and people understood that he had an enormous amount of integrity, that you couldn't buy and sell Tony Mizaki. This guy was a fighter, a principled guy. And so he inspired, he was very important to the Labor Party, because even when we talk to unions that were not immediately in favor of the idea of starting a Labor Party, the fact that Tony Mizaki was behind it opened doors for us. They said, okay, Tony's, all right, let me hear what you have to say, because Tony's no fool. And so it was very important to have him, as well as some other labor leaders that were also very important in this effort to build a labor party. I don't know that we would have been able to do it without him, quite frankly.
Let me ask you then about how you got involved in the labor party, because in some ways you were unusual as someone who was an academic involved in the labor party, which really sought to be based in unions themselves. Tell us about your involvement and participation in the lead up to the formation of the Labor Party.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually an odd duck, if you will, although there were, I don't know, a handful of us across the country who were in academia because our efforts to be labor organizers didn't pan out at a difficult time in the 70s and early 80s. And so after 6 years of training as a machinist and doing a lot of in-plant organizing, I went back to graduate school to find another way to do good works in terms of the labor movement. So I was, as I said, unusual in that sense. But in terms of the work that I eventually did intellectually in terms of labor economics, those years that I spent in plants doing organizing at many different levels was instrumental to my understanding of so many of the issues that working people face, and also so many of the faults of mainstream economics, the things that they just simply didn't understand because of the theoretical world that they were largely limited to. But I had friends, close friends, who were close friends of Tony Mizaki's. And when this word got around that they were starting to talk about a labor party, and they needed some folks who understood about economics and were interested in doing this kind of work, I was really kind of perfectly situated to get involved. And so I was vouched for by people that knew Tony, and I was invited onto the interim steering committee. And it was that whole process from that 3-year period of Labor Party advocates up to the founding convention, where we battled around our program for economic and social justice and passed that at the convention, was probably the most exciting and most interesting and rewarding period of my life in terms of political and labor activism. So I feel very privileged to have had that experience. You could have peeled me off the ceiling when that Labor Party program passed at the convention. I should say, too, that so people get a sense of how significant this was. In 96 in Cleveland, June 9th, we had our convention. And there were over 1,300 delegates that represented 9 international unions, 100 local and state labor bodies, over 1.2 million organized workers. They all got together to form their own political party. So this included the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, the United Electrical Workers, the California Nurses Association, the Longshoremen Workers, the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way, the American Federation of Government Employees, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, and United Mine Workers. So this was a really significant beginning. Now, it didn't go far enough, and we needed a few more, especially some of the bigger unions, but it was a good start. And if a few other unions had gone on and supported us with resources, who knows? We would have been in a very different position today. I should also say one other thing, too, which was so prescient about Tony Mazzocchi. There were some moments where he would get very glum and we'd ask him, Tony, what's wrong? What's something's bothering you? And he would tell us a number of times. He said, guys, this struggle to build this labor party is so important. If working people in this country do not have a real political voice, if this continues and the Democratic Party continues to betray working people, somebody's going to come in and fill the void. And it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be ugly. If we don't show a path, a progressive path out of this mess, somebody's going to do it in a very ugly way. And they're going to use racism and all kinds of divisions, and it's going to get nasty. And he said this in the 1990s. And so here we are. We didn't build it. We didn't succeed. And that vacuum was filled by some very nasty stuff that we are trying to navigate right now.
Tell us about the key elements of the Labour Party's platform. You said that you were amazed when the part that you worked on to do with economic justice passed when the Labour Party convened in 1996.
I would like to again refer your listeners to, they can read the whole Labour Party program. If you just search thelabourparty.org, all one word, thelabourparty.org, you can go to the website where the Program for Economic Justice and a few other documents are there for anyone to read in their entirety. And I really urge people to do that because it really is an excellent basis to engage in current discussions of the importance of things like the public sector, securing employment for all, a worker-oriented approach to trade policy, universal health care, and many other issues. So if you're interested, get a full reading of it. I think you'll be surprised how timely it still is. In fact, I was just thinking about, you know, wishing that AOC and some other progressive leaders had access to the Labour Party program, because I think it would be helpful to them. I should also note that a lot of the Labour Party program was ultimately adopted by Bernie Sanders for his presidential campaign. So it continued to have influence in that form. When you read it, you'll see that it's a thoroughly progressive program for economic justice that clearly recognizes that there are profound conflicts of interest between capital and labor. So it's quite radical, if you will. In the program, you will find no references to win-win programs or labor management cooperation schemes. In fact, at the conclusion of the preamble, it says, the Labour Party understands that our struggle for democracy pits us against a corporate elite that will fight hard to retain its powers and privileges. This is the struggle of our generation. The future of our children and their children hangs in the balance. It is a struggle we cannot afford to lose. So, and I should say that when we read that at the convention, people had tears in their eyes. They had that kind of language just, I don't know whether it would be suitable to read the preamble.
Sure.
So it starts out, the preamble to the program. We are the people who build and maintain the nation, but rarely enjoy the fruits of our labor. We are the employed and the unemployed. We are the people who make the country run, but have little say in running the country. We come together to create this Labor Party to defend our interests and aspirations from the greed of multinational corporate interests. Decades of concessions to corporations by both political parties have not produced the full employment economy we have been promised. Instead, income and wealth disparities have widened to shameful extents. We offer an alternative vision of a just society that values working people, their families, and their communities. And I won't go on, but it was a very stirring thing to have that pass. People hadn't heard that kind of language that values working people for many, many years. In fact, there's a generation there that were at the convention and others that hadn't heard it at all.
Howard, you know, one of the things that is striking in that preamble that you just read to us is that it actually mentions the unemployed. Unions, as you've said, as you were mentioning Tony Mazzocchi's observation that, you know, unions function in sectoral ways. They protect their workers, but they don't try to organize other workers, and they certainly don't try to organize the unemployed. How did that shape the Labor Party's outlook? Why was that language there?
It was there to signal that this was a very different kind of effort than people were used to. And going back again to what we talked about, the 1930s, in the 1930s, the labor movement was very involved in fighting for the rights of unemployed people. And there were unemployed councils. And again, a lot of it had to do with people on the left, but it wasn't unusual for unions to be concerned about that because the labor movement was acting as a movement as a whole. And so we wanted very much, that was part of the whole idea of the Labor Party and the program, was to begin to raise the consciousness of working people in unions that were so used to thinking only about their sector. We had to think more broadly, and that's the role of a party, a political party, is to think about the working class in all its aspects. I tell you, I've had sat in union meetings sometimes where people said, why are you fighting for health care for all? You know, that's what unions do. What do we have to offer our workers in our bargaining unit if they get it through the government? There is a real disconnect in many cases between unions in sectors and these overall circumstances of working people as a whole. And if you don't take seriously the issue of an injury to all is an injury to one is an injury to all, and the idea of solidarity for workers across the entire class, you are going to end up being divided and weak. The only thing we have is our solidarity. So we thought it was very important. And some people said, why is that in there? And we said, it's in there because unemployed workers are part of the working class. And it could happen to you next year. You know, your plant could be shut down and moved to God knows where, thanks to NAFTA, and you could be unemployed. So let's have a little more generosity and let's think about working people, all of us, because it's the only way that we're going to win anything. And, you know, and a lot of unions who have been through struggles, they do understand that. If you're on strike and you're not taking care of the other people in the community and you have been exclusive and you have been privileged in the way you fought for your the rights of just the people inside a plant, that's going to come back and bite you. You have to do things in the community. You have to have that broader sense of solidarity if you're going to win things. And so that was very important for us to put that in there. And that winning that program overall, we thought, okay, this is going to be a great educational achievement because there are going to be things in that program that a lot of people didn't necessarily want. Abortion rights is one of the issues that maybe we can talk about. And a very, very strong program for ending bigotry and for affirmative action and no discrimination against anybody. Those things were vital to put into that program. But within a whole program that's talking about working people and their needs as a whole, their needs for employment, their needs for a shorter workday, their needs for a powerful union, you put all of those issues together and people begin to understand how that all works. You can't take those issues separately.
Howard Botwinick is my guest. He's a retired professor of economics at SUNY Cortland and was involved in forming the Labour Party in the 1990s, which is the subject of our conversation today. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, of course, an effort to build a Labour Party is going to bring together people with very different views on things, including things that might be dearly held values of the left. And I wonder if you could tell us about how the question of abortion roiled the Labour Party at its start and the stakes of that fight.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent example of how we need to think about those kinds of issues. So originally in the platform, there was a very clear right for women to have, it was in the healthcare program, and to have full access to reproductive services, including the right to an abortion. And on the very eve of the convention, the labor, the committee that I was on that was developing the program based on many thousands of suggestions from people, we were just about to finish and present it the next day. And we are told that Valdemar Velasquez, who is a wonderfully progressive labor leader of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, wanted to meet with us. It was an urgent meeting that he asked us to have. And so he comes in and we sit down and he tells us that his people, who many of whom are devout Catholic farm workers, don't want that abortion plank in there. They were shocked to see it in there, and they are not going to stay in the Labour Party if that stands in the program. And Valdemar said, I don't understand why you put that in there. That's not really a labor issue, and it's so controversial. Look at all the divisions you're causing. Why can't we just take it out? And so we all look at each other and say, oh man, this can't happen. We can't have the farm workers walking out on us. How are we going to resolve this? And so first we had to explain to Valdemar. He said, look, there's no such thing as no controversy here. If we take that out of the program, which none of us want to do because it's vital to women's rights, then most of the women on that convention floor and a lot of the men are going to be absolutely furious with us. So forget the idea that if we take it out, there won't be any controversy or any division. That's not going to happen. So the question is, how can we move forward from this? And someone got the idea. They said, Baltimore, what if we take the word abortion out of the program and we just say that women should have, here, I'll read it to you, unimpeded access to a full range of family planning and reproductive services for men and women, including the right to continue or terminate a pregnancy. So we suggested that, and he said, listen, that might work. Let me send that, go back to my people, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. So we're sitting there on pins and needles because this would have been so terrible. And he comes back, I don't know, in about half an hour, and he says, we're in. That works for us. Thank you for taking our concerns seriously. And then we said to him, he said, Valdemar, I hope you know, and your people should know, that because we're using a different word doesn't mean that the Labour Party is not committed to the right to an abortion. And it could very well be next year that there could be picket lines or some fight somewhere in some city about abortion rights, and it'll have a Labour Party sign out in front of it, and we don't want any misunderstandings about that. We are supporting it, but in deference to you, we're taking that word out. And so we hit the floor with that amendment, and there were a couple of feminists that were pissed at us that we didn't use that. And they made some good arguments, and I'm not making light of their opposition, but it felt right, and it was one of those learning moments of, and this is something that so many people on the left need to understand how to do, and you only get it by doing it, by organizing with people that don't agree with you on every issue, that we have to find a way to compromise and be pragmatic and move forward.
I'm speaking with Howard Botwinick. He was involved in forming the Labour Party in the 1990s. Our discussion revolves around that today. For 2 years, he served as vice chair of the New York Labour Party for 2 years and was one of the primary authors of the Labour Party's Program for Economic Justice. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, earlier you were saying, Howard, that the impetus for the Labour Party came during the 1990s when the Democratic Party moved further to the right under Bill Clinton, NAFTA, the reform to terrible effect of the welfare system, that all of that led people to the conclusion that they really needed to have a party that was not the boss's party, that workers needed a party of their own. And yet, of course, unions in this country have a long history and are deeply connected to the Democratic Party. How did the Labour Party navigate its relationship with the Democratic Party, and to what degree did that shape its ultimate demise?
Yeah, I mean, that was the rock upon which the Labour Party foundered, ultimately. We, as I said before, the Labour Party could have, we'll never know, but, if a couple of major unions, larger unions with larger resources, had gotten on board and signed on and given us some significant financial support, we could have done so much more. As people should know, that we had, at our high point, we had three or four organizers across the country working full time. That was it. Full time to organize a national labor party. Clearly, we needed more money. We need more resources. The AFL-CIO spent $65 million on the 96th presidential election. If they had given us one of that $65 million, what we could have done with that at that time, I can't tell you. But we couldn't get the unions to take those baby steps. We got a few, and they were the most progressive unions that signed on. And we were careful to the other unions. We said, look, we know that you need the Democratic Party locally in your region, in your state, to push for things that your members need. We're not asking you to abandon the Democratic Party right now. What we're asking you to do is to spend a small fraction of that money and your resources and send us some of your folks who are interested in building this alternative party without going directly against the Democrats initially. And so eventually we will have some place for us to go, and our anger at the Democratic Party will take on much more meaning. And in fact, for all we know, it could greatly increase your leverage within the Democratic Party to have this alternative movement building. But people were too scared. They were so afraid of, and it's sad, really, because they were so afraid that if they alienated the Democrats wouldn't continue to do things for them, so they hoped and thought. But as we know, the Democrats didn't do anything for them. And they hoped and dreamed, and it never happened. So we never really figured out that way to continue to relate to unions who are outside the Labour Party and build that party and get some resources to do it. It didn't come forth, and it's tragic, I think, because we would have been in much better shape had we done that a while ago. I still think, though, I would say that kind of effort makes a lot of sense today. I don't know what shape it'll take. We have some more progressive people in the Democratic Party now, like AOC and quite a few others, that might ultimately help us to build some alternative. So what form it would take, I don't know, but I do know that we started right with the labor movement and its institutions. And without a significant number of unions behind any kind of effort to move politically, we will not be able to accomplish anything. So I don't regret that piece, and I would argue to do it again. And people should understand there were some things that happened that were hard to predict, and they were all negative. One of them was that the AFL-CIO's effort to organize just fell apart and led to an unproductive split between some of the unions. One of the unions that we were hoping to bring on board was the Teamsters. Ron Carey was the president. He had won this wonderful strike. He had led the strike that said America doesn't work part-time when part-time jobs were exploding, and UPS won that strike. And he was a very progressive guy, very possible he would have come on board. He got booted from the Teamsters union because of some financial shenanigans of people underneath him. And the Hafas came back into leadership in the Teamsters union. SEIU was another union we were hoping, the service employee union. Andy Stern initially was giving us some money. We thought that he was moving in a more progressive direction than he ultimately did. But if a couple of those unions had come on board, we would have had a very different situation. I'm hopeful the UAW is moving in the right direction. They're winning some exciting strikes. Sean Fain is a very exciting guy who's leading the UAW right now. There's interesting things happening in the Communication Workers of America. There's some things from the bottom up that are percolating in terms of teachers and a number of other areas that are exciting and interesting. So I haven't lost hope about this effort yet. But I do think ultimately we need to do this. We need to form a party that really does unabashedly represent working people and take that contradiction head on. I think it's the only way to unite people around a program like that.
Let me end it, Howard, by asking you about lessons today, which I realize is a very tall order because I don't need to tell you that we're living through a particularly unusual moment right now, one which may potentially shape this country for generations. And it's a time obviously quite different from the 1990s when the Democrats moved to the right but were in power at the end of that decade. In 1999, there was the mass protest against the WTO in Seattle, a general sort of upswell of the left. And we've certainly seen a real upswing of the movement cycle, so to speak. But we also have the far right in power. What lessons do you feel like could be taken from this history in the 1990s to now? I mean, you did say how there was a recognition even back in the 1990s by the leadership of the Labour Party that if the left of the labour movement didn't create some kind of alternative, some kind of pole of attraction that was pro-worker and to the left, that the racist right would step in. And of course, we're seeing that. So what lessons would you draw, given that it's obviously tricky to compare two very different moments?
Clearly, on one hand, the Democratic Party's betrayal of working people and the resentment against the Democratic Party by large amounts of working people, I think it's never been clearer. It's probably there's more resentment about it, the Democratic Party now, than there was in the 90s when we formed the Labour Party. People are not necessarily totally clear about why. Part of it is that people feel that the Democratic Party speaks for elite, highly educated people and not for them, not for working people. And it always sounds hollow when they talk about it. I mean, if we look at the last election, Kamala Harris was given a very tough situation. And, you know, of course, Biden should have never run his second term. It should have been done properly and all of that. But she did not speak nearly loudly enough about what was happening to working people. I'm not even sure that she understood it fully, given who her advisors were. But there was a lot of pain out there. And people were concerned about rising prices because they were already in very bad shape. All that inequality that I spoke about in the 90s that prompted us to do the labor war, that has gotten far worse, as Bernie constantly talks about now. I mean, these billionaires have just accumulated such a concentration of wealth and power. It's unbelievable what's happened here in this country. And then, of course, now we also, the thing that we didn't understand in the mid-90s was climate change. So we have a existential threat bearing down on us right now as well. So we are in a terrible crisis. But again, we have a left that's not really organically connected to working people. And we have to try to find a way to solve that. And if we don't solve that, we will be spinning our wheels and on single issues for until who knows what is going to happen. But I think the urgency of the need for either pushing the Democratic Party very significantly to the left, which I don't think is going to probably be possible, or building something else that can stand alone and can do all the things that we tried to do in the Labor Party, but more successfully, I think we're in huge trouble. I don't know what else we can do except for pursue those kinds of politics and develop some kind of an organizational form on a mass basis that can bring working people together around some kind of platform like the one that we developed. Doesn't have to be exact, of course, but something along those lines. I don't see the alternative, or whether we're just going to keep getting beat up if we don't do that.
Howard Botwinick, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Sasha. Thanks for the interview.
I've been speaking with Howard Botwinick. He was on the Interim National Steering Committee until the founding of the Labor Party. He served as vice chair of the New York Labor Party for 2 years. He's a retired professor of economics at SUNY Cortland and author of Persistent Inequalities, Wage Disparity Under Capitalist Competition. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.